This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a pleasure for me to be speaking with Jay Waljasper, author of a new book called All That We Share, A Field Guide to the Commons, and here's a long subtitle, too, How to Save the Economy, the Environment, the Internet, Democracy, Our Communities, and Everything Else That Belongs to All of Us. Jay Waljasper, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going fine. It's nice to hear your voice. I remember you from back in the day at the Dudney Reader, and I haven't seen you for a long time. And then this book came along, and it's a subject that interests me and has interested me for a long time, the commons. Why don't you explain what the commons is?
Well, the commons is really a very old idea. It's been kind of an organizing principle of, you know, human civilization since almost the beginning. But it's getting a new currency, and it means really all the things that belong to all of us. I tried to come up with the shortest definition I could for the title of the book, All That We Share. And the commons, you know, it's funny because you kind of go, yeah, okay, that makes sense. And, you know, the national parks are commons and, you know, maybe the air and the water. But actually, it goes way, way beyond that. The Internet is a great example of the commons, and so are the radio airwaves, which we're making use of right now. And, you know, just across the board, you know, Social Security and a lot of scientific knowledge and most of human culture, those are all commons. It's a great inheritance that really belongs to every single person.
But in a fundamental way, the commons has been shrinking. I was going to say eroding, but it's not exactly a natural thing. What's been happening to the commons?
Well, the commons, yeah, it's really at the same time as we're rediscovering it right now, it's also under probably more threat than it ever has been, you know, in human history. There's sort of two ways that we lose our commons, one of which is that sometimes it's just simply stolen from us. That's called privatization. We've seen that a lot with the radio airwaves, where it's something that belongs, according to U.S. law, the radio airwaves belong to everybody. But today we ask almost nothing from the people who make billions and billions of dollars from using the airwaves. The other way we lose the commons is through little nibbles. You know, we neglect them. You know, we suddenly, the park and down the street and the community center, they're all looking pretty shabby. And pretty soon no one really wants to go there. And then pretty soon they cut the hours. And pretty soon they shut the whole thing down because no one's going there. So there's a commons movement that's kind of rising. It's small right now, but I think it's gaining steam. And it's just people sort of standing up and saying, no, we want to protect what's ours. And we actually want to extend what's ours and make sure that everybody has access to it.
Jay Waljasper, this commons movement, is there a group or a couple groups you can flag that are doing some of the work here in the United States anyway?
Well, yeah, it's like I said, we're in the early stages of it right now, but I'm involved with an organization called On the Commons, which was actually my co-author on this book. And we're a kind of a commons movement strategy center that's really trying just to get the word out about the commons and also get the idea into people's heads that there's a lot of practical applications. It's not just another abstract theory that's great to talk about at cocktail parties, but it really offers sort of a set of tools for people to think a little bit differently about how they approach civic issues. And there's a number of other groups. Most people right now working on the commons probably don't think of themselves as commons organizations, but anyone that's working for digital democracy, anyone that's working for social justice, most environmental organizations, and just, you know, anybody that's really trying to increase people's access to public services and cut back and fight back against the cutbacks on public services, such as we saw in Madison, those are all people, whether they know it or not, that are involved with the commons movement.
You mentioned the environment a second ago, and you have a great introduction in this book, All That We Share, by Bill McKibben of 350.org, who is one of the leading environmentalists and now leading activists in the country. How'd you get him to do this?
Well, I've known Bill for a long time, and he's been, you know, he's written here and there about the commons, and so he was very gracious to do the introduction. And I think he really nailed it. One of the things that he brought up, which is one of the first questions that I often get when I'm talking about the commons, is, well, what about this whole notion of the tragedy of the commons, you know, which everybody seems to have read while they were in college or high school in science classes. You know, the tragedy of the commons was an essay from 1968 saying that when no one has private ownership of a tract of land or any other resource, then that resource will inevitably be degraded. You know, and that's kind of logical when you first think about it. But the problem is that isn't how it works in the real world. This was a speculative essay. There was no science. There was no empiricism in it. And in fact, the whole notion of the tragedy of the commons was kind of blown out of the water by a woman by the name of Elinor Ostrom, who's a political scientist at Indiana University. And she was co-winner of the Nobel Prize in 2009 for economics, the first woman to win the economics prize. And, you know, she's researched for 30 years throughout the world looking at commonly held resources and seeing how they really work in the real world, not just in sort of the speculative thinking of economists. And in fact, she found out, you know, from working in Kenya, in Nepal, in Turkey, in Switzerland, in Los Angeles, in Guatemala, that people are not stupid. They don't just simply trash a common resource that belongs to all of them. They come up with systems of governance that take care of the commons.
I mean, not
those can be.
Excuse me for interrupting, Jay. Not only are they not stupid, they're not selfish to the core. And that's selfish to the core seems to be the presumed assumption of all, you know, neoclassical economists or all libertarian economists.
Yeah, and you know, so it was really exciting when Ostrom won the Nobel Prize for this work, because she really, you know, has she wrote, you know, kind of the key text on the commons called Governing the Commons. But in fact, people figure out, you know, sometimes it's through customs, sometimes it's through government regulations, sometimes it's through other means. But they come up with a way to protect this and make sure that it's there for everybody to use, and in fact, to make sure that it's there for successive generations.
And, you know, if you just joined us, this is Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive. My guest today, Jay Waljasper, author of All That We Share, A Field Guide to the Commons. And the commons can be anything from the public library to the air we breathe and the oceans and the lakes and the streams and the internet and a lot in between there. But it's this idea of something that is shared, that we get enjoyment from, that we can use and keep for generations to come. But the idea of the commons, the very idea of it, runs counter to this ideology of the private, which is astonishingly still in the ascendancy here in the United States.
Yeah.
And I don't know how we're going to get over it, but how do you rebut that or counteract that ideology of the private?
Well, I hope that the commons can function a little bit as kind of an aha moment where people kind of go, oh, there's all this stuff that isn't privately owned, and in fact, it's really important. And that might give people the occasion to sort of think that, well, you know, the market is not the answer to every single problem that we have. And that's really, essentially, one of my colleagues came up with the phrase market absolutism, and that's really the culture that we're living under. I mean, both the economic system, the economic policies, but also almost the way that we think now is that, you know, there's no problem that can't be solved by just putting it over to the magic of the market. Yet actually, when you start studying the commons, you realize, man, I am so happy it's there, because we just got 12 inches of snow yesterday. And I am so grateful that government exists to plow my street, because I would have a sore aching back if I had to go out and shovel the entire street. And in fact, I'm really glad, too, that I don't have to have a water filtration plant in my backyard. And in fact, another form of the commons is municipal water systems. And so really, all around, you know, there's, you know, and certainly everyone understands that government, there's some things that government does poorly. There's some things that government, you know, isn't the best at. But there are many, many things that it's the most efficient an effective way of working together to get things done.
You know, in this book, All That We Share, A Field Guide to the Commons, which is edited by Jay Waljasper, you've got a lot of essays in it, and other people do too, and sometimes those essays kind of run into each other, especially on this subject that you just mentioned, which is the role of government, because there's an essay by David Bollier, who I admire a lot, talking down socialism, if you will, saying that socialism isn't the answer because it's centralized and bureaucratized, even though he does not at the government role in establishing parks, libraries, etc. But then, you know, about 100 pages later, you write something that says it's time to talk about government ownership again. Did that clash ring in your ears too?
Well, I mean, I always love the, my favorite metaphor is it simply that diversity is what makes ecosystems strong, and I think it's also what makes political movements strong. So, yeah, there's within the commons movement itself, there is some, I wouldn't say that it's disputing, but there's, you know, there's a wide range of opinions. And some people, you know, the commons doesn't necessarily mean the government, because in some ways, a lot of citizen initiatives, what we saw in Egypt and Tunisia, what we saw in Eastern Europe in the late 1980s. Those are also commons as well, where, you know, citizens take initiative to solve problems. And in fact, and this is what makes it really interesting, one of the things I mentioned in the book is that there are even elements of the private sector that function as commons.
Could you elaborate on that, Jay?
Yeah. I'm thinking the best example is just your neighborhood coffee shop, which, is legally a private business. But most coffee shop owners that stay in business and thrive understand that they're really not in the business of dispensing caffeine. They're really in the business of giving people a place to gather, essentially creating a commons. Now, those aren't, you know, the coffee shop owner could say, no, you can't come in and talk about the war in Afghanistan in my coffee shop. So they're not real commons, but they function in communities as commons. So the commons is kind of broadly focused. But I do think that one of the most disheartening and, I think, destructive elements of American culture right now is this sense that government can't do anything well and that, you know, government is really the enemy. And the commons movement, I think, offers us a great tool to fight back and say, you know, these cuts in public services. And, you know, the recession that, you know, we're still not out of yet, I think that also can be a catalyzing moment. Right now, I think a lot of people are scared, and they're kind of retreating back to the good old American, let's just do it through private enterprise. But I think as the recession wears on, people will understand that all these public services that are being slashed by politicians that refuse to raise taxes, that's really hurting, you know, everybody but maybe the top 2%.
And also, okay. Jay, I mean, there I go, interrupting you. God, I'm sorry I'm being so rude today.
this is a conversation.
It's hard by phone, though. I'm so used to doing it in person. But the amazing thing is that people are still talking about the free market as a solution when it was the free market that destroyed the economy.
No. Yeah, no, and that, you know, that's a really important point to drive home. But I think when people start feeling in their own lives, in their own neighborhoods, the consequences of all these public cuts, they're going to suddenly realize, hey, taxes are not altogether a bad thing, particularly if we get a more progressive tax system where the people at the top who have been paying less and less taxes over the last 30 years suddenly pay their fair share.
I'm speaking with Jay Waljasper. He's the editor and author of many of the essays in this book called All That We Share, A Field Guide to the Commons. I'm Matt Rothschild, the interrupting editor from the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. If you could trace the concept of the commons as an American idea, I know you have there's a chapter in the book on that, Jay. There are deep roots going all the way back to the founders.
Yes, exactly. And that's one of the kind of myths that I think needs busting. You know, we have this notion that America was built on the basis of just private enterprise and people striking it out alone. But actually, a great example that I did not even mention in the book because I didn't kind of come across it until later is, first thing we have to say, of course, the Native Americans provided us with all the land for the westward expansion, and they were pretty much, we know that story.
And also their notion of, you know, till the seventh generation is a great
about
the commons.
Commons. Really, you know, indigenous people can actually teach the rest of us quite a bit about the commons in action. And thinking about the seventh generation, you know, because so many of the decisions we make that trash the commons are really ones that we're disinheriting future generations. But anyway, one thing, you know, just a classic example of American history, when this was actually even before the Constitution, the Continental Congress kind of mapped out a strategy for settlement in the West, which in those days meant Ohio and Minnesota and Wisconsin, was that in every township, they would set aside 1 square mile that would be there for the benefit of public schools. So really, from the very beginning, there was a common sensibility that said we're going to set aside some of this land, and that's going to support the public schools. So that kind of just right away, you know, knocks down the idea that it was just, you know, enlightened greed that sort of, you know, allowed us to conquer the continent and create a vast, prosperous industrial country.
And you talk about.
Oh, yeah, you kind of look throughout the rest of, you know, the rest of American history, the commons, you know, the labor movement, the women's movement, you know, all the social movements have really drawn on the spirit of the commons. And, you know, the New Deal and the progressive era, you know, in which the Progressive magazine, you know, came into the world, those were also kind of drew upon this sense that, you know, that the we is sometimes just as important as the me.
Yeah, we, not me, or you know, the commons, the commonwealth, Those are the common wheel. Those are concepts that were, especially common wheel was kind of a concept that was in vogue in the early part of the progressive era. And we just got through our 100th anniversary. We went through all those back issues, and there was a lot of discussion about the commons and the privatization of the commons back in the 19-teens and 1920s, for instance. Yeah. So this has been a theme that's been with us a long time, and it's kind of delightful to see it come back. You're helping bring it back with a lot of the other people who write in this book, All That We Share. Do you want to mention some of the people you got in there?
Yeah, it's not a star-studded cast, but Robert F. Kennedy Jr. did a great piece about rivers, the Hudson River as a commons. Robert Rice, the former Secretary of Labor, wrote a piece that said essentially we're not going to solve our economic problems till we understand the commons. Jeremy Rifkin, the great social critic, had a piece pointing out the medieval roots of the commons, and and then some of my colleagues from on the commons, Peter Barnes, one of the founders of Working Assets, has a commons-based solution to global warming.
What would that be?
Ivan Illich is in the book. Peter Linebaugh, some people know him as a great historian of the commons. Mark Dowie with Mother Jones for many, many years. So it's, just a lot of people from a lot of walks of life, and I wanted to represent a lot of points of view here because, the commons is a rich, rich vein of thinking, and, there's not a strict party line around the commons, but there is a general agreement that we are headed the wrong direction in American culture right now.
Talk about that commons solution to global warming, because it also was something Bill McKibben was drawing attention to in his introduction.
Yeah. Well, the idea that the Obama administration put forth was something called cap and trade, which they've tried that in the European Union. It hasn't worked so well. Essentially, it's to use a market-based notion that people, have to buy pollution permits to be able to put carbon into the atmosphere, and that each year there's fewer and fewer of those permits, which makes them more and more valuable, and that companies can trade them back and forth, and that incentivizes them to reduce their carbon emissions. But the problem with that plan is it's not very popular, and one of the reasons it's not very popular is because it essentially gives ownership of the sky to the companies that historically polluted it.
Mm.
And so what Peter Barnes came up with was something called cap and dividend, which is that, you can do the trading of the pollution permits, and that may be an effective way to reduce the carbon emissions. But the benefits of those, the proceeds from that trading, should not go to the companies themselves, but should actually, through the government, go to taxpayers. So then suddenly we would all see an incentive to we'll get some dividend out of this. And in fact, any plan to reduce carbon pollution is going to mean higher energy prices. So the dividend that we'd all receive would be a way to help us pay for our higher gas and electricity and gasoline bills. So it's been introduced in Congress. Of course, it did not get very far, but neither did cap and trade last year. So it's a different way of looking at it. Now, other people would say a carbon tax would do that just as well. So that's another kind of commons-based means. But why I like to talk about this plan is it means the commons is not just sort of a abstract topic for debating societies, but in fact it really offers inspiration and practical measures to tackle some of the problems in front of us.
One of the things, you mentioned proceeds a second ago, and that brought to mind inventors. And a lot of inventors, even of contemporary things, they try to take all the profits out. When in your book, you notice that the government has often been responsible for some of those inventions or part of some of those inventions, like the internet, and these business people are capitalized on it and trying to take all the profits away. And there's a counterexample, a great counterexample of Jonas Salk. Do you want to talk about?
Identify kind of commons heroes, people that have really done a fabulous job, and oftentimes just local people. They're doing something. Jonas Salk, it's a great story because he was, the inventor of the polio vaccine, one of the two polio vaccines, and, saved millions of people's lives. And he was interviewed by the great journalist Edward R. Murrow and Murrow asked him on TV, network TV, who has the patent on this vaccine? And Salk just looked at him with kind of a quizzical look and said, "The people, I guess. How could you patent a vaccine? That would be like patenting the sun." And another great American who refused a patent on a very lucrative invention was Benjamin Franklin. The Franklin stove, which was probably one of his most popular inventions, he never took a patent down on it. Just simply that he said, because I have drawn so much inspiration from the people that came before me, I think that people should be able to draw upon my ideas as well. You know, so there's a lot in American history that contradicts this notion that it's, that was only the market and private property that made the country great.
Another part of the book that I thought was interesting, J. Wall Jasper, was this idea that we should come up with a new language of collaboration. What's some examples of that?
Well, so often our language in a lot of ways has been almost colonized by the market, you know, in the sense that we talk about, you know, the public interest and that sort of interest on revenue. You know, we talk about equity, and equity is, a form of ownership. And so what a new language of the commons would do would sort of come up with more words that are kind of based on collaboration. Because it's one of the market absolutism, one of the ways that it really has become so pervasive in our culture is that it's become sort of the metaphor by which we look how everything operates. You know, we tend to treat everything as if it were a business these days. And yet one of the key points of all that we share is that, you know, so many of the things that are really important to us are not businesses. And so we need to come up with more metaphors, more examples, more symbols that aren't, you know, just playing to the idea that, you know, all the world's a market and the rest of us merely consumers, to paraphrase Shakespeare.
I mean, it's like the bottom line. I mean, the bottom line is a business assessment.
Yeah.
At the end of what used to be called a spreadsheet, you know.
Exactly. So there's really, you know, and so that's one of the exciting things about the commons, is it isn't just simply a set of policies and procedures, but it really is a kind of a different way of thinking about the world. And I think that's what excites a lot of people. They can sort of see that commons-based solutions and commons-based living, aren't just about fighting back against, the market economy. They're also, life is just richer when we have more connections with the people that we live among, when we do kind of more things together. I mean, one of the great metaphor for the commons, I think, is the potluck dinner.
Hmm.
And so maybe that should become one of the metaphors we use in describing other topics and issues.
I just hope they're good cooks when they're coming to that dinner. That's all I'm saying. Before we move more toward that potluck, and it does interest me, I just wanted to ask you, there's a line in this book, All That We Share, A Field Guide to the Commons. I'm speaking with the author, J. Wall Jasper. I'm Matt Rothschild from The Progressive. A line that says McDonald's claims to own 131 words and phrases.
Yeah.
Where does it get off owning the language?
Oh, I'm loving it. Trademark. Like, no one has ever said that before. Some ad agency thought of that up for McDonald's.
And they've trademarked that?
Yeah. You know, you deserve a break today is another thing they've trademarked. The trademark thing is, I mean, this is, you know, if it wasn't so sad, it would be kind of funny to some of the things that people have tried to trademark. One of my favorite stories is that, you know, of course, the schools are all short of money these days, and so they're turning to corporate sponsors, to try to be able to field a basketball team and paint the walls and the hallways. And so there was a school in Georgia, you know, home of Coca-Cola, that got a lot of funding from Coke, and they... So they had Coke Day, and so one scamp wore a Pepsi T-shirt to school that day.
What happened to that kid? No way.
I mean, that is really, you know,
no
that
way.
Is really tragic. You know, and I think it's so funny, you know, for those of us who are sports fans, to kind of look at, you know, how many of these ballparks suddenly have changed their names because, you know, all the board of directors of the company that named the park are all in prison, you know, or the company went bankrupt or something like that. I mean, you know, what happened to the good old days when we just had, you know, White Sox Stadium and Wrigley Field, you know?
Well, it's another reason we love the Green Bay Packers, because it's community owned. It is
exactly,
part of the commons.
Exactly. Yeah.
Let's get back to that potluck dinner, though, and because you have a chapter or an essay called Reinventing Politics that you yourself wrote, J. Wall Jasper, and that is about politics at the real, almost potluck level, at the neighborhood level.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, this is a movement with worldwide implications, but I think for a lot of people it just starts right in their own backyard, in part because, you know, everybody, you know, it's a big world, it's hard to make changes when you have the people in Davos and the G20 meetings making all the rules that, you know, that affect everything in the economy. But the place where you can kind of make your stand is right in your neighborhood. And I'm always convinced that that's often people's way in to becoming dedicated activists, is that, you know, they see something going wrong in a neighborhood that kind of gets them out of their, you know, their Barca lounger and into the streets. And, you know, oftentimes they have a victory. You know, a road widening is stopped, or, you know, something that was going to be forced down their throats doesn't happen, or there's some good thing that does happen in its place. And suddenly they kind of realize, hey, we can make a difference in the world. And those are the people who then eventually start to look at the bigger and bigger issues. Because I think too often people have sort of dismissed, you know, small-scale community activism as being, oh, that's just not in my backyard stuff, or that's just kind of piddly stuff that really won't make a difference in the world. But really, when you take what people do in their neighborhoods and add it all together, it adds up to a lot. In fact, my previous book, you know, I will confess, my previous book was called The Great Neighborhood Book, and it was really all about what people can do to make a difference in the neighborhood. So, I mean, so that's where people start, and I think the Commons is a cultural as well as a political movement, and, you know, the Commons, you know, it's a, life in America can be kind of lonely with your, you know, just getting your Netflix DVDs coming into the house and surfing the internet and sometimes not making kind of connections with the people that live among you. And the Commons kind of gives you that reason to kind of go out in the street, say hello to your neighbors, and say, hey, look what we can do together. You know, for those of us who live in the snow belt here, you know, you kind of wonder, geez, does everybody have to own a snowblower? Can't, you know, we maybe just have one snowblower and pay some neighborhood kid to do the block or something like that. So just simple cooperative things like that are as much a part of the Commons as trying to sort of change the rules and undo the Citizens United court ruling. But those, you know, but it's all important. I think what people do individually in their own lives and what people do in a more collective sense in the broader world, you know, those things kind of connect up and feed one another.
You're reminding me of something that Kurt Vonnegut once said, and he wasn't into emailing a lot. He liked walking his letters and his bills down to the local post office because that's where he could meet his neighbors and talk to his neighbors. And he said, the purpose of life is to fart around.
I remember that essay. I love that essay. And public spaces are a big notion, are a big element of the Commons that really enrich our lives in ways we don't even understand until they're gone. Yeah, you know, we have the problem today, though, is where more and more people, you know, shop at the mall, and the mall is not a public space; it's a private space. And oftentimes you can't circulate a petition there, or there's usually no benches because they don't want you sitting down; they want you to, you know, to go from Williams-Sonoma to, you know, the next door to the next door after that.
My former boss, Irwin Knoll, the longtime and great editor at the Progressive magazine, was once arrested for passing out the Bill of Rights in a shopping mall.
I
can believe that.
I know, and you know, it really is. I mean, that's a perfect example of privatization. You know, on Main Street, you know, you couldn't, you know, scream obscenities or pull your pants down, but you could, you know, hand out leaflets and you could, you know, get people to sign petitions because it's a public space. You know, and you have rights in a public space, whereas you have virtually no rights in a private space. So as more and more space gets privatized in our country, then, you know, one wonders, I don't want to be too negative here, but one wonders, you know, there's not a lot of public squares in American cities anymore. You know, because you have the State Street Mall in Madison, which is great. But, you know, one wonders, you know, would it be able, could there be an Egyptian-style uprising here in the United States? Would we actually have the physical public spaces to do it?
Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah, I'm not sure.
We're out of time, but we've made use of that physical public space in Madison, Wisconsin recently to occupy. Including occupying the Capitol. It was an extraordinary thing. Unfortunately, Jay, we're out of time.
Today's
Jay Wall Jasper's
is
been my guest. He's the author of All That We Share, A Field Guide to the Commons.
You can
find it at onthecommons.org. Thanks
Madison,
so much for being my guest today, Jay.
53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.